Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It's 7:05 in Accra and 10:05 in Kampala. Welcome to Africa Link, coming to you live from Bonn, Germany. My name is Abubakar Jallo. In the next 25 minutes, anti-government protests turn violent in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
We are marching because we hate what is happening in our country. Firstly, President Kabila does not want to leave his position and does not want to organize elections.
Mali has unveiled an restored ancient mosque that was partly destroyed by jihadists.
It's very important because the value of cultural and religious buildings is absolutely fundamental in daily life in Mali and particularly in Timbuktu.
And worms are invading farms in Ghana, leaving farmers completely helpless. Stay tuned to these stories and more here on Africa Link.
Top story.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, clashes between anti-government protesters and the police erupted on Monday that left more than 24 people dead. 14 civilians and 3 police officers died, and at least 57 people were injured during the protest. Demonstrators were demanding the resignation of President Joseph Kabila after his second term mandate ends in December.
We are marching because we hate what is happening in our country. Firstly, President Kabila does not want to leave his position and does not want to organize elections. That's why today we are forced to protest to show our dissent for the 2016 elections. If Kabila does not respect the Constitution, we too will apply Article 64 of the Constitution.
Now, these opposition protesters accuse President Kabila of plotting to extend his tenure in office by delaying the elections. Earlier, my colleague Eunice Wanjiru asked DW correspondent in Kinshasa, Patrice Chitera, to describe the situation in the capital.
In Kinshasa, the police and some units from military police have been trying to clean up roadblocks that were set up by protesters. The police fired tear gas. I saw, for example, the offices of the ruling party have been burned down, as well as the offices of other political parties allied to President Kabila coalition. There were attempts by protesters to come back on the street and set up the roadblocks that police is also trying to clean up. And in other several towns of Congo, there have been attempts to go and protest in front of the offices of the Electoral Commission.
There have been reports of fatalities during the protests in Kinshasa. So what led to the violence, whereas this was supposed to be a peaceful march?
Yeah, it was supposed to be a peaceful march. Opposition supporters were gathering at the monument of Lumumba. And when they started marching toward the city center, some of them went on attacking the ruling party's offices along the way and other offices of other political parties, allied to President Kabila. That moment when the police came in and started to disperse, tear gassing, one protester was shot dead, and he became the point of protest with opposition protesters trying to take his body to an area where the rally was supposed to be held after the march. Unfortunately, they didn't arrive at the end because it turned violent. Clashes between police and the supporters who were trying to throw stones to some police units.
And has the government or the opposition said anything so far in regards to people's demands?
Yeah, first the government, through the government spokesman, Lambert Mende, has said that the march has been cancelled because it turned violence, and there were no way to allow it to continue as planned. And on the other opposition leaders, among them is Freddy Matungu Ngulu, former finance minister, who had been saying that they were provoked by the police and they couldn't do anything to control their supporters. That's why they must turn into riot or violence. And he said, for them, this is only the beginning of several actions they are trying to. They will be staging until December, which is the end of the last term of President Kabila.
Patrice Chitera in Kinshasa, and we apologize for the occasional drops in that line there. Now, many observers do not think that President Kabila has plans to hold elections. Eunice Wanjiru asked Phil Clark, a political scientist at SOAS, University of London, whether there are chances that the president may change his mind as a result of this protest.
It's looking increasingly unlikely that another leader will take control of the Democratic Republic of Congo. All of Kabila's moves over the last few months suggest that he's doing everything he can to remain in power. He's been delaying the elections as long as he possibly can. I think most commentators in Congo expect Kabila to try and change the constitution to allow him to run for a third term. And in the meantime, Kabila is also targeting opposition political leaders and supporters. There's been a really systematic crackdown against the opposition. So all of this suggests that Kabila is likely to cling on to power with all of the means at his disposal.
We have some representatives of President Kabila who recently flew to the U.S. to argue against proposed sanctions on members of the ruling government, that is, if elections are not scheduled. Were they successful, or will sanctions be put in place?
International donors are very reluctant at the moment to put sanctions on Kabila's government. Firstly, because Kabila is a very effective aid partner with many of these donors. Many of them have a very good working relationship with him. And in the past, they have seen him as the only stable actor that they can do business with. Secondly, many of the donors have tried to use sanctions against other members of Kabila's government in the past. And I think the view is that those sanctions have largely been ineffective. So I think at least at the moment, the international donors are very reluctant to go down the sanctions route. They will try to use diplomacy and other mechanisms, but I think it's only if those other means fail that the donors will consider using sanctions once again.
It is well known that DR Congo has never had a peaceful transition of power since independence. Are the current protests and arrests a sign that this trend will continue?
I think that's very much the atmosphere in Congo at the moment. If we look at the protests against Kabila's rule over the last year, the pattern is always the same. Large numbers of protesters go out onto the street calling for Kabila to step down at the end of his second term. The government cracks down very heavily against those protesters using both the police and the military. And then behind the scenes, the government continues to arrest political opponents and civil society leaders. This is really increasing the temperature right across the DRC at the moment. And I think the real fear is that the protests are likely to increase as the elections are still delayed, and the crackdown against civilians is likely to lead to more violence. So there's a real concern in Congo at the moment that this situation could get drastically out of hand over the next 3 to 6 months.
Phil Clark, political scientist at SOAS, University of London, speaking about the protests in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
Accra, we have a situation. That's an emergency call by Ghana's Ministry of Agriculture as it confirmed an invasion of worms on farms. The worms have destroyed large acres of farmlands in the northern part of the country over the past few months. They are spreading fast, and this, according to the ministry, is threatening the livelihoods of thousands of peasant farmers and food production in the country. From Tamale, northern Ghana, Maxwell Souk reports.
It is mid-morning. And Adam Abdullahi, 52-year-old farmer at Nyampala, is out to inspect his maize farm. As I walk with him round this field, it is obvious that Abdullahi isn't happy with his farm this year.
There is no hope. In the mornings, I don't even feel like visiting the farm. Only God can tell when it will get better. The crops are not promising at all.
Thousands of smallholder farmers are already counting their losses as a result of the worm invasion. According to scientists, these worms are not found in Africa. They attack the leaves of maize plants so that they are unable to grow and produce. The regional plant protection officer at the Ministry of Agriculture, Christopher Yilkari Akai, says the pest invasion is reaching an alarming rate.
So it's very dangerous and it can lead to total loss of the crop or any range of losses up to 100%, depending on the stage of the crop it attacked. If farmers are unable to control, it means there's going to be a reduction in food supply next year or after harvest.
Laboratory and this
is the laboratory responsible for investigating the issues of pests and diseases in northern Ghana. Ahmed Seydou is an entomologist working with the Savannah Agricultural Research Institute.
The pest is an outbreak. So when we saw them, actually were strange. It was strange for us, but we carried on. Now we have the larvae going through pupation to become adults. So we are getting these adults, the larvae, and we'll predict control measures.
The pest invasion have been reported in six other regions in Ghana. The Ministry of Agriculture says it has gathered similar reports in parts of Nigeria and Togo. At the moment, the farmers have been advised to spray their farms every 3 days. However, a plant breeder in Tamale, Alidu Haruna, says,
This is difficult. In fact, the peasant farmers, a lot of them have just left their fields to the mercy of nature. Because in the first place, they don't even have the money to spray even once a month, not to talk about every 3 days.
Government is yet to respond to the farmers' cry. But the Ministry of Agriculture wants government to consider the outbreak as a national disaster.
Maxwell Souk in Tamale. Coming up, Mali unveils a restored ancient mosque destroyed by terrorists, but first, finding employment through baking in Uganda.
Africa on the move.
Now, the Ugandan government has been struggling to come up with programs geared towards reducing the high level of unemployment among young people. Over the past decade, Uganda's economy was growing faster than any other country in sub-Saharan Africa. But now, only about 10% of its young workforce can boast of a job. Harriet Kakonge, a Ugandan, has a unique idea, a baking business. Nadina Schwarzbeck and Alexia Getman met her, and their report is now presented by Wanjiku Mwaura.
Harriet Kakonge is a self-made businesswoman, a mentor, and a coach. When the 43-year-old failed to find a job a few years ago, she ventured into baking. Her baking career has been a blessing to her and many young people in Gayaza, a small town not far from the capital, Kampala. She teaches young unemployed Ugandans to bake bread, biscuits, and her special birthday or wedding cakes. For Kakonge, it's about giving the young people a perspective.
I feel happy to help people without jobs because personally I'm a living example, and it's through that experience I went through that I'm doing it. I've ever been without a job and I didn't know where to begin from. So I've been encouraging people to do whatever they can.
In the past 2 years, Kakonge has trained 300 young people. She largely finances the courses from her own pocket, while 15 of her students are government-funded. 28-year-old Grace Amanda has been coming here for 6 months.
Before coming here, I was seated at home doing nothing. To come here and learn something, I used that time to earn something like money to support my family.
It's a great opportunity for Grace, who has been unable to work in the area. Even a university degree is no guarantee for a job nowadays. According to a survey by ActionAid, two-thirds of working-age Ugandans under 30 are unemployed. On top of that, Uganda has the overall youngest population in the world. Kakonge thinks that the Ugandan education system should provide more chances for the youth.
The job situation in this area is very difficult. Maybe the education set up in Uganda is training people for white-collar jobs. So if you haven't gone to school, you won't get the white-collar job. And those who have gone to school find it difficult to get one.
One of Kakonga's former students, Nora Namia, has used her training to open her own cake business. The 30-year-old now runs a small roadside store and is happy about her independence.
It improved my income. I can pay school fees for my children and rent a house.
Kakonge is proud of such students. They give her the strength to continue as she juggles the work in the training program and her own shop in the center of Kampala.
Nadina Schwarzbeck and Alexei Getman compiled that report. From East, let's head now to West Africa. In Mali, the restored main gate at Timbuktu's 15th century Sidi Yahya Mosque was unveiled on Monday. The gate was destroyed by Al-Qaeda-linked Ansaruddin Islamist in 2012. This came after a senior Ansaruddin leader, Ahmed Al-Fakhi Al-Mahdi, was sentenced at the International Criminal Court after pleading guilty to war crimes. The United Nations Cultural Organization, UNESCO, had designated the Timbuktu Mosque as a World Heritage Site, and destroying it amounts to war crime. What does this mean for the people of Timbuktu? A question I put to Paul Melly, a Mali expert and associate fellow at Chatham House in London.
It's very important both in practical term because value of cultural and religious buildings is absolutely fundamental in daily life in Mali and particularly in Timbuktu, which has a reputation as a very important religious and cultural center in the country. But it also has a political weight because if it sends a signal that Mali is not going to allow its overall equilibrium, if you like, as a society and as a polity to be permanently changed by the events of 2012 when jihadists over the north of the country.
You were saying that this is a symbol of resilience from the Malian government and as well the international community there. But as we've seen so far, the security situation in North Mali is still volatile. How sure are we that something is not going to happen to this new restoration again?
Well, we can't be sure that it wouldn't be attacked again. It's almost impossible to protect against terrorism without completely unbalancing a country by allocating all of the resources to security.
Now, human rights groups, including UNESCO, have also they've described the destruction of this of the mosque there as a war crime. So, what's the degree of seriousness? How important are these manuscripts and this mosque that were destroyed by the jihadists?
Well, I think what people need to remember is that Timbuktu is a very, very ancient center of learning. It was at the southern end of a caravan route from Morocco as far back as the medieval era. There is a very long tradition of exchanges between Timbuktu and other centers of Islamic learning, such as Fez in Morocco. The libraries in Timbuktu, an extraordinary array of documents, most of which fortunately were saved during the jihadist occupation. Most of the documents were either hidden or smuggled out of Timbuktu to safety. Some were damaged, but the overwhelming majority have survived. And similarly, the mosques and the tombs of the saints in Timbuktu are very important expressions of the city's history and culture. So it really is one of the most important cultural centres in West Africa.
Paul Melly, a Mali researcher at Chatham House in London.
Making a difference.
In Making a Difference this week, we meet 49-year-old Menge Ondu Ntiene. Ntiene is an albino who, through his music, has changed how many in Cameroon perceive people living with albinism. At a younger age, Ntiene, whose stage name is Calvino, has had to deal with a lot of discrimination, with people calling all albinos evil. Moki Kinteka has more.
Calvino uses the mvet, a traditional musical instrument popular among the Fang people of Cameroon, Gabon and Equatorial Guinea to thrill his audience in the Equato-Guinean capital Malabo. He has been invited by artists from the three countries in recognition of his fight against ordeals facing people living with albinism. Calvino says, like other albinos, he grew up physically and psychologically tortured. At the age of 15, he says, a military officer called him evil when he ran to him for protection. But that never discouraged him to fight for the rights of people living with albinism.
Au début, on montait dans un taxi, les gens descendaient, on montait dans un bus, les gens descendaient.
At the beginning, when an albino boarded a taxi or entered in any public transport, people would come out in protest. That is what motivated me to create an association of albinos.
La solidarité des albinos, je suis le maître fondateur de cette association.
In Cameroon, like in many African countries, albinos suffer from prejudice and are often rejected by their families. In other more extreme cases, many have been killed and their bodies dismembered for ritual purposes. In Africa, some believe albinos possess magical powers. Calvino says such perceptions are now changing and his government has started to support them through education.
L'albinos ne voit pas loin, n'est-ce pas? Et les écritures qui sont petites sur les épreuves.
An albino does not see an object in far distance. Small writings on the blackboard are difficult for them to read. Now the state has asked for the characters to be increased so that albino children can be able to read alongside other children in classrooms. So the writings is in bold character now. We helped to pass that message.
Donc on a fait passer le message.
Tamba Clementine, who comes from northwestern Cameroon, where albinos also suffer prejudices, says she's getting well with albinos.
I was afraid of them, but now I'm no more afraid of them. And some people are afraid of them because of their color and the way they look during the day. They used to shake their eyes. There was one year in my workshop, and I was used to her. Then I used to sew her dresses. She's a nice person. She has a good heart, she behaves well, so I've been taking her like my mom.
Cameroon's social worker, Awemo Patrick, describes Calvino as a courageous artist whose songs are touching the hearts of many.
Through his music, the songs, the message is going across, and the authorities are really taking it seriously. His music is great towards telling people that there are people who have equal rights in the society. There are people who can think, who can act, who can do things that normal human beings can do in Cameroon.
Calvino says the number of albinos graduating from universities is gradually increasing, and the systematic elimination of albino babies dropping, but he still has the mvet and his voice as weapons to fight against social injustices.
Moki Kinseka reporting. Elsewhere in the news, judges at the International Criminal Court have reported Kenya to the Assembly of State Parties, that's the court's governing body, for failing to cooperate with investigators in the failed prosecution of the country's president. Kenya's president Uhuru Kenyatta was accused by the Hague-based court of crimes against humanity. The prosecutors dropped the case against President Kenyatta in 2014 for lack of evidence, saying Kenyan authorities repeatedly failed to cooperate fully with the investigation. That's all we had time for. If you have any comment, please send us an email to feedback.africa@dw.com, a letter to AfricaLink DW 53110 Bonn, Germany, or a text message to +491609575951 And as always, thank you for listening. And until tomorrow, I am Abubakar Jallo in Bonn. Have a wonderful day.